40 years ago this weekend, the CDC reported a cluster of a rare form of pneumonia among 5 gay men in Los Angeles. The ensuing pandemic put its mark on a generation of Americans. Doctors, certainly, and care providers and politicians, also pharmaceutical researchers. And, of course, the millions of Americans diagnosed HIV positive and all of those who loved and know them. The AIDS crisis was so influential on society and healthcare. It's kind of hard not to think about it right now as we're processing this stage of the COVID pandemic. Celeste Watkins-Hayes is a professor of sociology at the University of Michigan. She researches inequality through the lenses of gender and race and class. And she joins us now. Celeste, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's an honor to be with you.
HIV and AIDS had undeniable consequences in how LGBTQ people move through society. Your research also lights up the lives of women, and especially Black women, who contracted HIV and perhaps AIDS afterward. You wrote an entire book about their experiences. What do we know about them? How many women went through getting a positive diagnosis for HIV?
That's a great question. So we know that Black people are disproportionately impacted by the HIV epidemic. And when we look at the numbers, we see those disparities for men and for women. So when I was conducting my research, Black women made up 61% of all women who were living with HIV. HIV was the fourth leading cause of death among Black women ages 35 to 44 when I was conducting my research between 2005 and 2017. So what we see with the HIV epidemic is that it's an epidemic of inequality. We see that groups that are disproportionately impacted by HIV are also groups that are socially marginalized often on the basis of race and gender and sexuality. And Black women absolutely have borne much of the brunt of the epidemic when we look at the trends among women.
For years and years and years, people who were HIV positive got sick and died, and there was not a whole lot done for them. And then over time, drug therapy surfaced, drug prices evolved. What did you observe of how the women you talked to, how they fared over that time?
Well, it was really interesting because when we talk about the story of HIV, there are some notable successes. We now have the science to end the epidemic. We now have highly antiretroviral therapy that assists people living with HIV and moves HIV from a death sentence, which is how many of us understood HIV and often experienced HIV in its early years, to moving it into a chronic manageable illness, meaning that if you are able to get tested, get diagnosed, get on medications, antiretroviral therapy, you can live a long life. And in fact, what we're seeing also is that people living with HIV who are taking their medications as prescribed can get to a place where they have undetectable viral loads, which means that they can't sexually transmit. So the scientific advances around HIV have been significant. But what we've seen is that the scientific advances have not been enjoyed equally across populations. Part of it is a question of people getting access to information around testing, knowing that they might be at risk, knowing that they should get tested, finding a place to get tested. And then once people find out that they may have HIV or do have HIV, making sure that they're getting consistent access to healthcare. Because what's so critical about managing HIV is an ongoing and lasting relationship with the healthcare system. You've got to regularly see your doctor, your healthcare provider. You've got to regularly take your medications and get access to medications and get your blood work checked. So for people who are grappling with stigma and really struggling with their HIV diagnosis and don't want a reminder frequently that they're living with the illness, for those who are economically marginalized, who may not have health insurance and access to consistent healthcare, and for those who are grappling with many, many other life challenges, it becomes difficult to manage an HIV diagnosis in addition to everything else that sometimes people are managing, whether it's a mental health issue or a drug use issue or just an economic survival issue. It's hard to go in and regularly check your viral load and see your doctor and take your medications every day if you are worried about where your next meal is coming from. So the next frontier as it relates to HIV is, yes, a continued scientific push for better medications, better access, thinking about potentials for vaccines, potential for a cure. But for now, highly antiretroviral therapy is proving to be extremely effective at reducing the numbers. But the real frontier we've got to talk about is how we deal with the inequities in terms of who's getting access to those resources. And we also have another very powerful tool in our arsenal to fight the epidemic, and that is PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. And those are medications that HIV negative people can take to prevent acquiring HIV, to prevent HIV transmission from happening to them. But that too is a question of access. Not a lot of people know about PrEP. So it really becomes incumbent upon people to ask questions of their healthcare providers. And it's also critical for healthcare providers to get better versed on the capabilities and to be able to offer those capabilities to their patients.
What you're saying sounds so familiar in such an awful way, as we are now in a place where Black women and men are, once again, those most being affected by a pandemic, being COVID. We know what to do to inoculate them, and yet the disparities in terms of care and vaccination rates and hospitalization rates in our Black and brown communities in Michigan are just frightening. I feel like some people felt the sheer scale of COVID led people to think there would be a great awakening, but what's not happening right now?
Well, I think that many of the lessons from HIV, some apply to COVID and some don't necessarily apply to COVID. But one message that applies to both epidemics and pandemics is the importance of information, making sure that people are getting access to information, and the importance of trust. The same dynamic happened when highly active antiretroviral therapy became available. People were skeptical. They were concerned about whether they would be effective, what the long-term side effects may be. And it was really the HIV community itself that played a very powerful role in getting the message out, talking to people, you know, talking about their experiences on medication, talking about how they were managing, and that alleviated a lot of the fears. So making sure that we're offering the message, but we're also making sure that the messengers are people that folks trust. So we've got to make sure that we've got a diverse army of people out there talking about vaccines, talking about the importance of getting tested for COVID-19, just as we do during the HIV pandemic. Because one of the things that's really interesting about HIV that I think offers a valuable lesson is the diversity in who's affected. We often think about just one population being affected. In the case of HIV, we often imagine a white gay male patient. But in fact, as I've written about in my book, HIV affects women. It affects a broad spectrum of the LGBTQ community, not just gay men. It affects low-income individuals. There's a number of different populations grappling with the issue. And what the HIV community figured out very effectively is that all of those populations have to be involved in the response. They all have to be involved in messaging and problem solving and creating solutions and figuring out what's going to work for those communities, what's going to resonate in their communities. And I think that if we can borrow those lessons with COVID and develop that diverse army and make sure that the access and the resources are there, I think it'll be very beneficial. And the other thing that we've got to talk about is not just issues around hesitancy and people's fears of medications, whether we're talking about HIV medications or COVID-19 vaccinations, but we've also got to talk about access. Where are we making the resources available? What kind of hours are we setting for the resources that are available? Are we making sure that we're attending to people's lives and meeting people where they are? A 9-to-5 setting is not going to be consistent with the lifestyles of a lot of people who need evening hours, who need weekend hours, who need childcare, who need transportation, and who may have a number of barriers to access that have to be alleviated. So I think the other lesson that the HIV community shares with the COVID community is access is critical, and we've got to be very creative and very intentional in how we reach populations.
Celeste, when you think about the place that we're in now with HIV, how things went from being a four-alarm fire over decades to becoming more of a manageable chronic disease, and what appears to be something like a step down now in our relationship with COVID, you've outlined very specific steps, but do you have any thoughts on how we keep everyone focused on the people who are at risk?
Exactly, because your question is getting to this point of complacency, this question of complacency, because what we find, and we saw this with HIV, is when the most resourced among us get access to the scientific tools, public awareness goes down, public attention goes down. It doesn't occupy our front pages and the lead stories in our nightly news. And what we see is those most marginalized who are still grappling with the pandemic are often ignored. We saw that with HIV. So, for example, when highly active antiretroviral therapy became available, we actually saw an increase in the number of AIDS deaths among Blacks. And what was happening was that there was decreased attention and decreased focus and resources in ways that some of the most marginalized within the HIV population, in the case of this example, Black people, found themselves under-resourced to fight the epidemic and ended up having high death rates because the most resourced among the HIV community got their medications. They had access to healthcare. They had physicians. They had medications paid for. They had private insurance. And all of that made it so that HIV was not a death sentence. And therefore, it didn't have the same kind of public push and public focus. So we've got to think about that in the context of COVID as well, making sure that as the most resourced among us get access to the vaccine, we don't take our eye off the ball, and we're still thinking about the most marginalized in our communities who don't have access to resources and how to think about how to bridge that gap. The other dynamic that we need to point out with COVID is our political division has really made it challenging in order to fight this public health threat. So part of what's driving vaccine hesitancy for some, we've had to grapple with political beliefs that run alongside vaccine hesitancy. We had some of that within HIV, but not to the same degree. So in that sense, we're in a slightly new era of thinking about how do we talk to each other across the political divide to make sure that people are getting accurate scientific information that can help guide their decision-making.
Professor Celeste Watkins-Hayes, sociologist at the University of Michigan. She's also the author of Remaking a Life, How Women Living with HIV/AIDS Confront Inequality. Celeste, it's a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.